Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Rampage, a state of anger or agitation resulting in violent, reckless, and destructive behavior. In 1989, Marc Lépine mercilessly executed 14 female students at Montreal's École Polytechnique to become Canada's most notorious mass murderer. The following year, spree killer Peter John Peters roamed from London, Ontario to Thunder Bay, leaving a trail of bloodied bodies, broken dreams, and stolen vehicles. Both men experienced the same devastating destiny. They embarked on homicidal rampages that shook their nation to the core. Lee Meller has gathered more than 25 of Canada's most lethal spree killers into a single work. Rampage details their grisly crimes, delves into their twisted psyches, and dissects their motivations to answer the question every true crime lover yearns to know: why? If you think serial killers are dangerous, prepare for something even deadlier. The book that we're featuring this evening is Rampage, with my special guest, journalist and author and publisher, Lee Meller. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for agreeing to this interview, Lee Meller.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be back.
Let's get right into this before we, a little bit later on, we'll talk about what you've been doing in the last little while. I understand you've been in Europe, and so maybe we'll be talking about what's latest in Serial Killer Quarterly. But for now, let's talk about really the motivation and the reason why you wrote and the focus of Rampage. You talk about multiple murders. We alluded to that in the introduction. So tell us about the focus of Rampage, why you wanted to do this project, and what is the focus of this project in the book Rampage?
Rampage was a book, it just seemed like the natural successor to my first book, Cold North Killers, Canadian Serial Murder. And I was thinking of doing it anyways as kind of a second book. And when Michael Carroll, who was the acquisitions editor from Dundurn, suggested it to me, I said, "You kind of read my mind." And so it just seemed to be the next step. There isn't really anything on mass murderers in Canada, the same kind of deal as serial murderers, or spree killers, sorry. And so I decided it probably wouldn't be interesting to do an exhaustive book of mass murders, because you just have a lot of guys, you know, killing their family members, unfortunately. That's probably the most dominant trend. But what I did is I took the 25 cases that I felt were the most interesting or illustrative of certain concepts or types of mass murderers and spree killers, and I put them all into Rampage. And the end product is there's some really diverse criminals in there, and it makes for a very interesting read. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. So, a lot simpler than the genesis of the Cold North Killers one. You know, it's just like, okay, well, it makes sense to do it next.
Right. Now, as you do in the book, let's define mass murder and spree killing. And I want you to explain really too, because I found it very interesting that you said this book serves as a didactic encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. So let's define mass murder and spree killing as opposed to serial killing. Tell us what is that inherent difference, or what you believe is the difference for the purpose of a categorization here. And also, if you could explain what you mean by didactic encyclopedia.
Sure. I'll get that first question out of the way. Second question out of the way first, because it's a bit, I can do that quickly. Most encyclopedias, of course, you learn something by reading them. That's kind of the point of them. So hearing that, I kind of think, I'm not sure that was the best word. But by didactic, I mean that you're getting an encyclopedia of these different rampage murderers, but at the same time you're learning about the concepts associated with rampage murders. So
right.
You're not just learning facts about the individual killers. It's also like themes, whether it's criminology, psychology, social elements that go into, or, you know, criminal justice system matters, which is always a huge thing, you know, when they mess up. And so, yeah, pretty much that's it. Just the idea that you're getting sort of like a vertical and horizontal learning in the same book. But at the same time, it's not a textbook. It's meant to be a good read.
And now for the second part of the question, what,
sure.
as you defined in the book, what's the difference between mass murder, spree killing, serial killing? What is the inherent differences?
Well, mass murderers kill four or more people in a single location. Now, there's a little bit of confusion and disagreement as to what constitutes a single location. You know, is it a classroom or is it an entire school? And that's never really been defined, and that's something I talk about in the book. I mean, at the end of the day, these are all social constructs. But to me, if it's like a building, you know, or a series of connected buildings, that's a single location. So mass murder kills
right.
four or more people in a single incident at a single location. So if you're thinking about in the U.S. right now, the guy in Oregon recently, I think that was the most recent one, isn't it? I'm losing track now.
Yeah.
The guy who shot up the school there, he would be a mass
right.
murderer because he killed four more people and it was in a single location. He didn't move to another location to do that. As opposed to a spree killer. A spree killer claims two or more victims in two or more locations, but it's considered to be the same incident in that the person doesn't really go back to their the routine of their life. Once they've committed to it, there go. And so it's really a mass murder that takes place over several spots and sometimes can span a week or anywhere from like a couple hours to a week.
And you're comparing these two because you just in the last description you spoke to, it's in comparison to the serial killer with the cooling off period. And so the spree killer is being compared to because that's the first model that people have had in the last 30 years or so was the definition of serial killer. So now we have you and others defining the spree and mass murder as compared to serial killer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something completely different, really, and you hit the nail on the head when you said it's about that cooling off period. And we can get in debates, too, of, oh, well, what constitutes a cooling off period? At some point, you have to kind of apply common sense. I would say that the thing with the serial murderer, they're now using two or more victims rather than three or more, which was they're
right.
using till 2005. But, this idea of a cooling off period is really what separates them from rampage murderers, which include mass murderers or spree killers, and that the serial killer doesn't want to be caught or is careful not to get caught because they seem to enjoy doing what they do. They want to be at large in order to commit more killings. So it's important for them to be able to kill, go back into the routine of their daily lives. And now that doesn't mean that there isn't some sort of still a sexual element that's still under the surface there. You know, they may have souvenirs or trophies, which they use as masturbatory aids or to kind of like existentially reminisce about these things. So they still always have a little fire going there, but generally they seem to return back to their lives and can do that for days, weeks, months, years. You know, as we saw with BTK, I mean, I think it was he held off killing for about 13 years after
right.
his last victim. So, they have the capacity to do that, whereas a rampage murderer commits, and once they're committed, they're committed. They may be at large for a bit, but everyone kind of knows who they are, and there'll be a manhunt, and yeah, so that's really the main difference, as much as we can put people like that into categories.
You also write that it's characterized also by this profound, or often, or most often, or quite often, this profound final event, which,
mm-hmm.
again, is much different than the serial killer motivation, it seems.
Yeah, that's it. A good way to think about a rampage killer is that it's kind of like a suicide note that's externalized to, rather than the individual seems to lose all hope for a normal life, and rather than going quietly, they decide to go out with a bang rather than a whimper, as the saying goes. And so they take people with them, and a lot of the times they will leave letters, especially with these new killers that we're seeing such so many mass murders in the States right now, and it seems like all of them are doing like these video blogs or sending out letters. Like, it's just commonplace now. It's almost like they want to broadcast, I existed, and I'm pissed off that I was denied a good life, and that's become standard. But we don't see that so much in Canada.
Yet again, we've got an extreme example with Luca Magnotta.
Hmm.
So I think if you've got Mark Twitchell and you've got, I don't know, a few other examples, I think everybody, regardless of where you're living, I mean, America is just the more glaring example, I think, but I think there's a lot of people in this, what they were calling malignant narcissism, where everybody wants a little piece of that 15 minutes of fame. It's symptomatic of a lot of people, and I think it's pretty consistent in terms of these new killers as well. But when we're speaking about a school killing, mass murder, let's talk about this incredible example that I spoke to in the introduction about Mark Lapine and the École Polytechnique, where 14 women were killed, 10 women were wounded, and 4 men were wounded as well. And this was December 6th, 1989. And so rather than the way you have it in the book, where we talk about the crime and then you talk about, and you've done an incredible job in amassing quite a background on each one of these cases. It's incredible the research you've put into this and the access and the information that you've dug up to really tell the story and really give a good character analysis of these killers. It's incredible. So let's talk about Mark Lapine. He doesn't start off as Mark Lapine. He changes his name at 13 years of age. So let's talk about his background, which is so important to tell the story of this Mark Lapine and this massacre at École Polytechnique.
Yeah, I really wanted to get into every background element with him, because typically when you see the story portrayed, it's that it's this woman hater. He's just a misogynist. It's a political thing, and of course they're at, you know, that is a part of it. But there's this whole iceberg under the water of trauma and seemingly like personality disturbances that sort of underlies that. So I really wanted to dig into that. Lapine's father was an abusive man. I believe he was of Algerian background, and this man, Rashid Garbi, because Lapine's name was Gamil Rodrigue Lias Garbi, Gamil actually meaning handsome in Arabic, and he was his mother and father had a very kind of unstable marriage, French Canadian mother, and Mark was kind of neglected as a child. His mother was working so hard under the sort of draconian father figure that, you know, she'd be typing things out all day, and he would beat her when she made a mistake. And often they would go out at night, and they would leave Gamil, later to be Mark, all alone in his crib. And they would. His father, as he got older, his father actually beat him once for singing. He woke his dad up by singing. You know, you'd think that'd be a nice thing to hear your son singing happy, but not in this case. And so they kind of lived under this tyrannical patriarch figure for a long time. And finally, he went too far. And I believe it was shortly after the incident where Gamil was beat for crying by his father, that his mother said, you know, that's it. And once she decided that she was going to leave Rashid, he just completely cut off all financial support whatsoever. So it left Gamil and his sister Nadia and mother Monique right at the, you know, where they needed social assistance and they were struggling to get by. This had the unfortunate effect of where the children were already kind of isolated and neglected by their mother, of deepening that because the mother was forced to go and work extremely long hours to try and get by. And so there were already a lot of damage happening there, and then the one person they can bond with, their mother, is suddenly kind of out of the picture. So Monique sent Gamil and Nadia to live with some caregivers throughout the week, and apparently they didn't adjust well to that. They always wanted to see their mom, but they couldn't do so. And at this point, Gamil begins to act out. He'd gone on a camping trip, I believe, with the caregivers, and he took like a propane tank, and I think he attempted to blow it up or something like that. But the point was that he was doing things to get attention. And so if you kind of weave all this together, you can start to see like where this really deep pathology of a murderer comes from. It's not just political. It goes all the way back to childhood. And when he's about 12, his mother's finally able to take him back. But now he's showing even more profound signs of disturbance. He digs a grave for his sister. He doesn't like his sister. It seems like she's always taunting him and digging at him. And this really undermines his self-esteem, especially as he's going into puberty. And he actually digs a grave for his sister in the backyard. And his mother catches him doing this and says, "What are you doing? Like, this is your sister. You know, fill the hole." And he's just kind of, never really explains it, but he just fills the hole back in. And at some point, Monique's cat goes missing. And she says, "You know, where's the cat gone?" And Nadia, Gamil's sister, says, "Well, I saw him strangle it with a rope." And Monique asks him about it. He says, "I didn't do that." But she never, ever sees the cat again. So this is as he's getting into puberty, also being called Arab, taunted for his, you know, half Arabic, I guess, mixed race background at school.
Right.
And so he changes his name to Mark Lapine when he's 13 years old. But, you know, right there, 13 years of, and you know, any of those things in isolation, or, you know, a couple of them, we'll see that in the lives of many people, but there's a lot of real subtle stuff adding up there to a really maladjusted young man.
Now while we're on still the warp psychology that this person is enduring here, he hates his father. It ends up he really hates his father, and his father has this very interesting life that's discovered by Mark's mother, in that he has two women by the same name and is leaving this completely double life. And like you say, the mother is a French-Canadian, not of Arab or Algerian descent. And his sister, Nadia, is, again, ruthless in basically taunting him. And his mother, as you say, because of the long work hours and a combination of other things, he's really being neglected and doesn't have any positive role models in terms of women. He has, as you write in the book, no real success in dating. He is incredibly shy, has acne. So we've got all those things. And he talks about earlier about this 7 years of no joy. And I may be just jumping ahead a little bit. But where is it, because you don't really point it out, but is there some connection with the mother refusing, because he does go back with his father briefly, you say in the book, so that there is some confusion in terms of his loyalty to his parents, but where does this feminism, this idea of feminism come from, or this idea that, again, either some traditional idea of what women's role is in a marriage or in the home, where does he get these earlier ideas that, again, will seem very important later in this story?
Well, I mean, he never actually sits down and tells us or really has much insight into what is going on with him. Maybe he didn't know himself, but if we can do a little maybe psychoanalysis or something like that, I think that the idea that his mother was always not there for him, like she was either going out with the father and leaving him in his crib. Mother admitted that she couldn't go in to comfort him while he was crying because of her controlling husband. So at some point he just stopped crying as a child. So this goes really quite deep, and then abandoning them as kids to try and get by. And now she's doing that in the context of a single mother trying to make it in the world. And she's devoting all of her time to work. Now, I think it's possible here that Mark Lepine begins to see women in the workforce, perhaps, as also as being tantamount to him being emotionally neglected and being alone. I think that's very possible there, too. Also, getting ribbed all the time by his sister must have really undermined his self-esteem. Like, there was a point where he was having his first kiss and his sister saw him and made fun of him, and I don't think he ever kissed anyone again that we know of. He was very, very sensitive to rejection, which he would be if he grew up in those kind of conditions. And there's probably some genetic factors too with his father being a violent man. And so anyways, to bring it back culturally, this idea that he's mocked by women and he's abandoned by a woman who wants to focus on her career. And even when she does get things back on track, she's still a very career-focused person. He's got acne, obviously very shy, undermined confidence. So when he grows up and tries to form relationships with women, he's completely got nothing going for him at all. And he starts to get defensive as a way to kind of protect his bruised ego. I mean, most people don't admit, hey, I'm just a total clueless loser. Like, that's not, you don't psychically survive mm-hmm. that way. So he starts to erect, defense mechanisms. And so he starts to get angry at women and starts to sort of project onto womankind as a whole. This also being, in the 80s, there are more and more women going into technical jobs, going into schools, and he's having to compete with them. And apparently he was really quite smart, good at his job, but he was always sabotaged by his emotional problems. When he was doing his schooling, like, he's constantly enrolling in post-secondary schools and dropping out, even though his grades are good. He's very subject to these sort of crashes, and he probably saw a lot of people who are less gifted than him doing well, and because of the way that he's blaming women for so much of what's going on in his life, he probably focuses on the females in that environment. And so this all culminates in him essentially being 25 and completely alone in this apartment and just watching action movies and horror movies all day. And he comes up with this plan that he applied to get into Ecole Polytechnique in Montreal, and they rejected them, as they would, because his grades were completely erratic and as really just indicators of what his emotional life was like. And so he's rejected, and he sees all these women getting into the engineering program, and somehow he forms all these narratives together, these separate threads, and turns it into he's going to kill women, really because he hates them, and he feels rejected by them. He doesn't understand them. He feels that they're the bane of his life. But I think probably to cover up how much of it is about him being inadequate, he sort of frames it in this pseudo-political way that he's a radical making a stand against feminism. And he probably believed that somewhat himself. He probably convinced himself of that. But it wasn't really about that, in my opinion. It was just about him being rejected by women, really in the later years, mostly because of his own doing.
We also talk about his hatred and his growing hatred for women, but also just before we set up this tragic event, this day, this incredible day, that he unleashes all of this anger and animosity towards women especially and some men. You describe very, very well, eloquently, how isolated this guy isolates himself, basically. This 8x10 room, You said he was just playing video games and sitting there with his computer, but his friends tried to get him out even for social events, and yet he still stayed primarily in all the time in this little room, didn't he?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's because by this point he's already so damaged. You know, he is a fully formed adult in a lot of ways, and he's fully formed damaged, and he knows that he's not going to fit. He doesn't know what to say to fit in. He doesn't know if girls are probably making fun of him or being sincere, doesn't know if they're interested in them or not. And this probably just leads him to be incredibly angry and frustrated and to look at himself every time he goes out and fails in these social situations. He's kind of confronted with the reality of who he is. So for someone like this, it's much easier for them to sort of protect their inflated ego by not going out, by just denying it all. And so that's why he wouldn't go out with his friends, because he knew that it wasn't about him not being able to meet women or to, you know, meet people who might potentially be his friends. It was his ability to know what to do to get to the next stage with them and to keep them. And he just didn't have that equipment in place. So to me, that's why he's staying in. And then he can lose himself in a fantasy world of violent movies ruled by these, you know, sort of alpha male characters, which, you know, he might identify with and start weaving a narrative to justify his existence based on that. And the next thing you know, you've got this guy who's taking a 223 semi-automatic machine gun and shooting up a polytechnic.
Well, let's talk about December 6, 1989. He's at the office of the registrar, and he has a gun, a 223 caliber semi-automatic rifle that he has bought legally. And amazingly, he's bought this for hunting small game. And he's got his rifle hidden in a garbage bag, and it's with him. And no one seems to take great notice of him at all, basically. So set the scene for us. What happens? He comes in, he's at the register's office, and he leaves, and he goes to the second floor engineering class. There's 69 students total. So take it from there. You have everything from exactly what he says. So tell us what happens.
Well, essentially, at some point, he just walks into a classroom. I'm just looking for which class it is here. It doesn't really matter. He walks into a classroom of engineering students, and the professor's just sort of like in the middle of a lecture, and they don't know who's in the class, so they think it's just this guy walking in late. And he walks in, and he tries to get everyone's attention, and at first they think it's a joke until he pulls out the gun, and suddenly he has exactly what he wants. He has his little moment in the spotlight for his time, his big dramatic ending, and he holds everyone at gunpoint. He orders all the male students out of the classroom until just the female students are remaining, and he asks them to back up against the wall, which they do. He's got a machine gun out, so they're pretty intimidated. Everyone's scared, and he starts saying things like, "You're all feminists. I hate feminists." One of the girls tries to reason with him. She's trying to say, "Well, I'm not a feminist. You know, I'm just a female student." But he doesn't want to listen. He's not in the mood for a discussion or to debate the finer points. It's really just about him now externalizing all of his anger on people. So the minute she starts to speak, he just unloads with the machine gun, and all the women fall down, most of them killed, many severely injured. And then he leaves that classroom, and he just starts to go down the hallways from room to room, shooting at students, mostly females, but as you did mention, he hit a lot of males too. And this culminates in a total of 14 dead and 14 wounded. The final victim, he actually kills with a knife. I believe he hit her first with some bullets, and as she lay dying, he climbed up onto this dais and pulled out a knife and just plunged it through her chest. And someone was there to observe it, and apparently his last words were, "Ah, shit," at which point he put the gun in his own mouth and killed himself.
And it was interesting, too, you even have the aftermath of that, is that one of the students, which was a male, who was ushered out of the room, and again, at first they separated the men from the women, and then he said, okay, you guys leave. You guys get out of this room. So he felt so guilty that he committed suicide. So tell us, again, and this is Canada and not the United States, so tell us the difference at that time in history, 1989, what the aftermath was of this murder. What did it ignite?
Well, it has December 6th now is a national Memorial Day for these women. It's like a women's rights day, and to commemorate this. So if Lapine went out to destroy feminism, he completely failed, actually had the opposite result. And as a result, there's more female engineering students now than there was back in 1989. So whatever war he was waging or thought he was kicking off, it didn't work. It's interesting to me to see he seems to have been sort of the first of these sort of misogynist, isolated killers. And now they're popping up. Over the past, you know, say 5-6 years, they seem to be popping up all over the place. I mean, we have Elliot Rodger and Cho and this guy, Merce or something, whatever his name was, recently in Oregon. And they're all, you know, saying, I hate women, I'm lonely, I can't, you know, and they're using different language, but they're all essentially saying the same thing. It's about social isolation. And so, specifically, it was there's this Memorial Day on and Women's Rights Day on December 6th, which is soon approaching. And that was pretty much the legacy of that. But as you said, there is someone who killed themselves. I'm trying to think now. Wasn't there there was a couple too that committed suicide? Am I remembering that correctly?
I can't say for sure. I know that it was just surprising for me to see that the one man had committed suicide. So I know that part of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if it was his parents. Anyways, I'll find that. But that's pretty much the culmination of you know, his big statement was reverse effect.
What about, because there's always the talk in the U.S. and Canada about the differences in gun control legislation. Was there any move on gun legislation? As I mentioned, he had legally obtained this gun. It was legal for other people to have a gun like this, a semi-automatic rifle. You said that, you know, it was interesting that SWAT teams would use this type of rifle as well. So, tell us about any changes at all or any discussion about gun control legislation as a result of this incredible crime.
Okay, well, but I have looked it up just as you were talking there, and it was, within a year of the young man's suicide, his parents killed themselves. So if you count those... Lapine's own sister became a heroin addict because of the fallout of the crimes and died in 1996. So if you count those as sort of like victims on the periphery, then, you know, it's like 18... Well, and if you include his own life, you know, he's killed almost 20 people as a result of his actions. So, yeah. Anyways, about the legislation that resulted from it. I think that if I remember correctly, they were doing a push to enact gun control and stuff on semi-automatics. But then I heard recently that you can still actually get that gun in Canada. So I don't know if it worked.
Mm-hmm. But it does seem to...
Yeah,
I mean, they recognize the anniversary of this killing in Canada. And it does, again, it's... Again, I didn't want to ask you a hard question on the real impact in terms of that discussion, but there seemed to be this was a, I don't know, firestone, if that's the right term, touchstone, pardon me, of that discussion anyway, about not only misogyny, but also of gun control itself and the availability. And so at least there was that discussion. Let's talk about another incredible...
It's spawned a coalition for gun control.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's talk about another incredible case that, again, is keeping in line with the recent... We just had police officers under fire and also under criticism. Let's talk about someone that had a deep, deep hatred for police, and that's James Roscoe, and ends up in an incredible, unprecedented murder of RCMP police officers in Canada. This is March 2nd, 2005. Again, let's talk about the incredible background that you've uncovered and put in this book, Rampage, about the incredible life, early life of James Roscoe.
Okay. Well, the Roscoe thing actually starts kind of innocuously. That's when he buys a truck from Kentwood Ford Sales of Edmonton, and it's a white 2005 Ford F-350, and he gets it on credit, and when they check into his history after the fact, they realize that he's got bad credit, that he has a criminal history, and so they send out bailiffs to repossess the truck, and they go out to his place in Mayerthorpe, Alberta. His place is basically like a compound surrounded by chain-link fences, and they are trying to get in there, and he's just telling them to, you know, fuck off and such, and he's got these really intimidating dogs kind of roaming around. I think they've heard some rumors about him being kind of a dangerous character, so they're a bit wary. And they come to repossess this truck, and he sort of just tells them to get lost, and then he gets in the vehicle and drives off. And so the bailiffs contact the RCMP, and they now have a probable cause to enter the compound. And when they go in, they find a chop shop. Basically, Roscoe has been taking these stolen cars, and he's been selling them out of there. And they also find that he's got a huge cannabis growing operation going on there. So he immediately becomes a wanted man, and he's gone. He's not there anymore. So they decide, well, we're going to post some RCMP officers here to watch the place while he's gone. And I guess they're collecting evidence and such, maybe seeing if he comes back. Well, he does come back. He sneaks back later that night, and he has a firearm. And he creeps in, and he hides in the back of this little hut, and he waits until the officers, there's very few of them on patrol. They didn't seem to know completely the kind of psychology that they were dealing with at the time, at least their superiors didn't. And when they enter this hut, he just unloads on them, and he kills four of them. And there's a big standoff, kind of shootout with police, long stalemate periods, and eventually Roscoe kills himself, but takes these four RCMP officers with him, and it's one of the worst massacres of law enforcement in Canadian history. And the kind of interesting part for me about this story is that the fallout of it is that they start to think about, well, did we calculate the risk properly in this situation? Did we really know who we were dealing with? And so they, Matt Logan, who is an RCMP, one of their main behavioral cops, he goes and he does sort of like an autopsy on this situation. He starts to dig into the background of James Roscoe, and he finds that this guy has a huge history of versatile criminal activities. He's paranoid against the police. He's done aggravated assault, several homosexual rapes, and at this point, Matt Logan starts to realize that this guy, James Roscoe, was a psychopath, and he should have been taken a lot more seriously. And so the hope is that next time they'll be able to spot someone like this. But am I confident that they will? Probably not. Not beforehand. But, I mean, that's the Mayor Thorpe Roscoe thing in a nutshell there.
Well, you talk about him being a psychopath, and you single him out as hitting all of the checkpoints for psychopath, as opposed to a lot of the other killers in your book, and you describe them in great detail and classify them accordingly. When you talked about Roscoe, though, you did talk about his incredibly disturbed background, his early life with his father, who at some point becomes severely mentally ill and starts talking about the apocalypse and doomsday and is embarrassing. So tell us a little bit about this earliest, because if you talk about psychopath, we look for the person that is just clearly not mentally ill. But in this mix, this confluence, we do have this mentally ill father and this bizarre upbringing as well, where not only is he spoiled, and not only is he preferred or a preferential treatment, but also he has this bizarre upbringing.
Yeah, his mother kind of mollycoddles him, and his father is a religious fanatic. There is always this sort of tension where his mother, Stephanie, would claim that the father her husband abused her. This was Roscoe's father. And he said that he didn't. So there was a lot of tension in the household about this. At the same time, the mother's mollycoddling him, and the father's coming across with this religious fanaticism. So it's just not a good pot for anyone. But, I mean, I think where the psychopathy thing becomes interesting is, I mean, he's from a family where he has quite a few brothers, and they all seem to grow up to be okay. But from the youngest age, he's showing signs of just being completely manipulative, self-entitled, and they could put that down to the mollycoddling. Apparently, he was just like the most adorable little baby, and everyone loved him, but this meant that he could get away with anything, you know, especially in the eyes of his mother. So he's growing up in certainly not a healthy situation, but neither are his other siblings. So you have to wonder, like, well, what is it specifically about this individual? And the explanation seems to be that, you know, that it could be the psychopathy, which is actually, you know, the genetic fluke. There's no evidence really that this religiosity or this abuse necessarily shapes his crimes. We don't see echoes of that in his crimes as specifically as we do in the case like Lapine. But it may certainly have had, I think more the him being mollycoddled probably gave him more of like a sense of entitlement, and, you know, that I don't have to pay my way in this world. I don't have to listen to any authority figures. I'm special. And, you know, this could have paved the way for him basically making his living as a criminal and always manipulating the justice system and always placing himself in opposition to authorities. At the same time, now that I'm saying that, if his father was this religious fanatic who he could not respect and who was always trying to impose his views on the children, I mean, perhaps it was the reaction to authority is something that goes back that far as well, to not respecting the authority of your father and not really having any authority from the mother. So that's pretty much Roscoe's. Yeah.
Sorry, I agree with you in that respect, in terms of she was always defending him when he was accused of sexual abuse of the handyman, for example. She denied that he would be able to be capable of anything like that. He didn't do any chores. And then he dealt drugs and he sold moonshine, and he just had this sort of disregard for authority, like you say. Where is it that he developed specifically this hatred for the RCMP? Why is there this hatred for the RCMP before this? Where does this come from?
Well, it was that he was living a criminal lifestyle, and he was always doing things wrong, you know. And so every time, if you do things wrong long enough, you know, of course you're going to run afoul of the police, but whereas most people would just see it as like, well, they're just doing their job and, you know, I'm doing illegal things and it's their job to stop me from doing illegal things, he becomes almost like kind of paranoid about it and starts thinking that they're out specifically to get them. But there was when he was 14 years old, he was caught by his father with marijuana, and his dad, rather than just sort of, you know, confiscating it, telling him off, actually contacts the RCMP and gets him in trouble for it. And this is sort of like the initial thing that kicks off with this. And maybe at this point he sees the RCMP and his father as kind of being like one and the same thing, in that, you know, people with these moral standards that are trying to crush his personal freedom, and, you know, these figures he doesn't respect. So the RCMP is first actually associated with his father when it comes into his life. And this is probably the event that begins the ball rolling. But he, as I said, he had a history of run-ins with the RCMP because he was always doing things that were illegal.
Did he have some specific officers that he had in mind? Did he have some list of potential victims?
Yeah, he did. He had lists of officers that I think that was something that they found later when they were going through his trailer. They found stuff like articles on the Columbine high school shooters, which is really kind of odd if you think about it. You've got this grown man who seems to be looking towards teenagers who committed a high school massacre before him. They found a stash of pornography. I think it was kind of like sadomasochistic homosexual stuff. They found photographs of James Roscoe actually giving alcohol to two adolescent males and sexually assaulting them. So they found, once they're actually able to go into this individual's world, because he had a lot of criminal charges, but I think only one time was he really convicted of something serious. And so it was when they were able to go into his personal space after the fact that they really realized the extent to which this person had, you know, plans to take out the police officers, and this sort of idealization of past mass murderers. And that was when it all kind of clicked, but it was too late at that point.
When people asked, or reporters asked, or police asked his father, how did his father describe his son, James Roscoe?
No, he said he was like a devil, basically, you know, using the same religious terminology that, you know, he wasn't surprised that this happened, really, and, you know, that James Roscoe wasn't really ever a good one. And, you know, normally we might say, well, you know, maybe there's evidence that the father had something to do with it. Like, what kind of message is that to send to your kid that, you know, you're a devil? But I think that perhaps he was seeing him for what he was. You know, there really are those people that are just born bad, and I think that's the father's way of expressing that.
Now, we talked about entitlement in this story, and we, again, there's about 25 stories in here. We can't go into all of them, but I think these are, we'll be able to get to three or four, which are a great example of what the book encompasses and is able to achieve in terms of a cross-section of different types of killers. And then, again, this very illustrative example of why they're in this classification and why they're different from each other. And it's, and you know, an amazing analysis of maybe why they came to be able to do some of these incredible crimes. So when we talk about entitlement, we talk about somebody that's got a little bit of a name in Canada, Alexander Keith, a famous brewery from the East Coast, and the not-so-ambitious and motivated Alexander Sandy Keith Jr. So you talk about him being a con man and an opportunist, politically and business-wise. So tell us a little bit about Alexander Keith first, the father, and what sort of the family had achieved, and then Sandy Keith and what he tried to achieve.
Okay, so Sandy Keith was actually, Sandy being short for Alexander Keith Jr., he was actually the nephew of Alexander Keith, who was famous. Yeah, that's okay. I do that all the time, too. He was, you would think it's his son, but it's actually not his nephew. And Alexander Keith, for anyone outside of Canada, is one of sort of the most prominent and successful Canadian brewers, especially, in the 19th century. And he comes over from Scotland, and he sets up in Halifax, and he starts to brew this IPA out there. And so he's kind of like a big man about town in Halifax. He's kind of the most powerful brewer, extremely wealthy. And meanwhile, he has this nephew, Sandy Keith, who comes over from Scotland sometime after. And Sandy Keith just really tries to leech off his uncle's fortune. His own father sets up a business which is in competition with his uncle, and he actually turns his back on his own father and goes over and sort of ingratiates himself to his uncle, becomes a bit of a sycophant. And so right there, you're seeing that he's just willing to take... he doesn't really have much loyalty. He's just going where the opportunity is. And once he's actually in the good books with Alexander Keith, he uses it to start sort of throw his weight around town in Halifax. And there's times where he actually impersonates Alexander Keith. So this already you're seeing kind of a similar thing. As you mentioned with Roscoe, it's this sense of entitlement and that lack of loyalty towards one's family, and this idea that, take the easy routes in life. And this eventually leads him to become a serial bomber and one of the worst mass murderers in ever to come from Canada, one of the most prolific, but also really, he's also a serial killer at the same time, not in the sexual sense, but in the sense that he probably killed multiple people on multiple occasions before the big mass murder happened.
So let's talk about the big mass murder, December 11th, 1875, and the steamship, the Mosel. And you talk about this big barrel that is being loaded on by workers, and it falls and it blows up. So tell us what happens in this particular case with this, what you've called the dynamiter.
Yeah,
Dynamite Fiend.
Alexander Keith Jr., one of the ways that he gets money over the course of his lifetime is to take insurance policies out on ships or on their cargo, and then a lot of them seem to sink for some reason, and he gets a big payout. And we have no absolute proof that he was necessarily responsible for most of these, but given what happened in the case of the Mosel, we can certainly assume so. And how kind of lucky, lucky quotation marks, can you get that every time you insure stuff on or these ships or insure the ship itself, it seems to go down? So he has a history of doing this. He's actually broke when he's living in Germany. Without getting into too much details about it, he was essentially a spy for the Confederates. That's right, actually, out of Canada in the East Coast, and working with the Confederate Army in the United States. And so when the Civil War ends, his fortunes kind of reverse, and he ends up broke and hunted by bounty hunters with all these enemies in the U.S., and him and his wife have to go to Germany and change their names and kind of get new identities. They have money for a while, but they live above their means, and they squander a lot of it on frivolous stuff, trying to live a lifestyle, like an upper-class lifestyle, hobnobbing with other sort of wealthy middle-class people, and they just can't really keep it up. And so the money starts to run out, and Sandy Keith goes, I need to do something about this. So he returns to his old ways, and he has an idea for this time bomb that is basically run by clockwork, and he starts visiting these clockmakers all over Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and he finally finds someone that can make like a clockwork time bomb to go inside inside this drum, which he's placing on the Mosel. And his idea is that it will go out to sea, and it'll blow up and sink. And then, because he has an insurance policy on it, or on some of the stuff on there, that he'll just get his payout as it was in the past. He's actually there, probably to ensure that everything goes okay, and he's watching them load things onto the ship. Unfortunately for him, it doesn't. And as you said, the drum falls off, it falls down, and it hits the deck of the ship, and it explodes prematurely. And just in front of his own eyes, for the first time, he has to actually see the devastation of what he did. And in total, there's about 81 people killed and 50 wounded. And it was just apparently this horrible sight. You know, people just dismembered and maimed and bloody all over the place. It was considered like an international disaster at the time, you know, something probably comparable to like the Malaysia Airlines of our own time. And it was just reported all over the world. And he is so shaken. He's either so shaken by what he sees or so sure that he's going to get caught, or maybe some combination of the two, that he actually goes down into his cabin below the deck, and he attempts to commit suicide. Unfortunately, for him at least, he fails, and it's this failed suicide attempt which leads authorities to start looking at him, and the doctors are trying to keep him alive, mostly to try and get details out of him, because they suspect he knows something.
Now, he's using an alias called UK Thomas, and so when there is this big explosion, they think that they're trying to save whoever they can, and then they find him in his office with a locked door. And like you say, he shot himself a couple times but didn't kill himself. So tell us what happens after that, and what happens, how do they discover that it's not UK Thomas and it's Alexander Keith Jr.?
Well, as I said, the doctors are keeping him alive for a while. They learn his identity and where his wife is. So she received a visit from a detective, and he told her that her husband had attempted to take his own life. The detective escorted his wife to Bremen by train, and when she arrived, the local investigators started to interrogate her. And at some point when they were questioning her, his wife, Cecilia, slipped up. I guess she was in on it to some extent, and she started to refer to him as Alexander, at which point they know that there's something amiss here. She sees her husband, and she starts begging for the doctor to kill him, to put him out of his misery. At the same time, she's pleading with her husband to repent, because she's a very religious woman. She wants to be reunited with him in heaven. After she left him, he says, the last words to escape his lips, I have been a thickhead. The fellows in New York are guilty. So he never actually really admits to it. He's still trying to lie at the very end there. But it's through the Pinkertons, with these little bits of nuggets as to his identity, that they begin to try and figure out who this man is. And these Pinkertons have been on his trail since his time in the United States, fleeing as a as a former Confederate agent, and eventually they put all the pieces together, and it just dawns on them that this is actually the nephew of Alexander Keith, Sandy Keith, and a person that's been causing trouble all over the, you know, North America, and that a lot of people have been looking for. And it's because he has this sort of notoriety and fame that they're able to connect Thomas and to Keith and realize it's actually one and the same person.
Yeah, incredible. Let's talk about one more story briefly, and then we can talk about some of the sort of analysis that you had from all, doing this and covering and investigating these 25 killers and their crimes and their backgrounds. So let's talk about Albert Gay, September 1949, mass murderer. And his claim to fame was, well, at least I die famous.
Yeah, but apparently was quite a coward on the gallows. So let's always keep that in mind. Albert Gay, he had a kind of similar thing to Alexander Keith. Albert Gay was a con man. During the war period, he managed to get out of really being having to serve overseas and being drafted. He would do things like steal watches, forgeries and stuff, and try and get by just as like a fraudster, petty thief. And he married this young woman who was beautiful at the time. He was working with her at like a, I think it was at a munitions factory or something like that. And they were very happy for a while until Albert Gay meets this other young woman as he's approaching middle age, and he decides that he's done with his old wife, and he wants to be with this woman. So they're carrying out an affair for a long time, and eventually the young woman wants to call it quits. Albert Gay says, no, I want to be with you, but she blows him off, at which point he thinks, well, if I have, my wife wasn't there anymore, and I had a bunch of money, then this woman is, of course, going to love me because I'm Albert Gay. I'm all that. So he puts out an insurance policy on his wife, and she's taking a flight out from Quebec City, just kind of a local flight to somewhere nearby. And Albert Gay has a bomb designed and put on the plane. And shortly after the plane takes off with his wife on it, it blows up and kills all these people, and he stands to benefit having had the insurance out on her. And so he's very dramatic at her funeral, and he's really playing it up as the bereaved, and saying things like, don't worry about me. I can make it, and then bursting into tears. But it's all a big charade, and some people become a little suspicious of him. And eventually, it's shown that he's part of a conspiracy of three people. Really, two other people he manipulated into helping him out with this. There was a woman who actually, she checked in the luggage, which contained the bomb. Gay didn't do that himself. He had this woman do it. And we don't know whether she actually knew what was in the luggage or not. It's sort of some controversy. And she was, when they finally did catch him, she was, she also got caught too. And how it all happened was she attempted to commit suicide when she found out what had happened, but she survived, and when she was taken in, she more or less confessed to everything that had happened. And then it led to this third person, the guy who designed the bomb, who is like an old crippled man. And so Gay and his female and male accomplice all were tried, all convicted, and all hung, and actually, well, hanged, I should say, and his female accomplice was the last woman to be hanged in Canada.
Interesting. What was Albert Gay's, again, we talked about his background, but what did you conclude about Albert Gay as you did in your analysis of other killers in your book? What was particular and that you gleaned from the case of Albert Gay?
It's hard to read Albert Gay himself just with any kind of confidence, because there's not a lot of sources about his personality. But I would definitely say that, like, yeah, he was certainly a narcissist, entitled, and very likely also a psychopath of sorts. Maybe not to the kind of extent that Roscoe was, because Roscoe had a number of criminal offenses, and it was very versatile. Gay stuff was mostly property crimes. At the same time, he was known to pull guns on people and such too. So he seems to have had maybe been a little bit more successful in Roscoe in some ways. But I would say that there's a chance that Albert Gay was psychopathic too. And I don't just throw that out there casually. I actually run the tests on them when I have enough information. And he has a lot of psychopathic traits. The ability to do that, really, to kill so many people just to get at one person, to have your wife out of the way and to get this insurance payout, unless you've got some kind of ideology going on, which he almost certainly didn't. It wasn't like a terrorist attack. It wasn't a statement. It was all meant to be sort of like as quiet as possible. So the fact that you could kill that many people that easily and not have it on your conscience and go on and live with your life, which is what a lot of these mass murderers don't do. They die with their victims or alongside them. But he wants to just return to his life with money and marry this younger girl. So to me right there, that indicates someone who's at the very least, as you said, a malignant narcissist, but, probably a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
No remorse, no empathy for anyone. And drag these other two people down with him.
Mm-hmm. What was with Albert, can you give us any kind of insight on how he possibly could manipulate these two separate people into aiding and abetting him? It's usually not. I could see the one partner. I could see someone you're having an affair with. This seems to be. Tell us on how he got these two people that weren't so connected to this, to him personally, to be involved in this incredible assassination.
Well, first of all, he picks people who are very lonely people. Like, he has kind of like I think she's a widow. Okay, that's it. She was known as the Raven. Her name was Marguerite Pitre, P-I-T-R-E, perhaps I'm saying that wrong. But yes, she was the last woman executed in Canada. And the other guy is a crippled old man. And it's through this, basically them being alone, that he's able to, as someone who's like a predator and a con man, he's able to see some kind of weakness in them, and he's able to capitalize on that by, befriending them and such. And once they're complicit to a certain extent, then he can use threats to get them to go along with him.
Mm-hmm. So there is some similarities, it seems, to the Alexander Keith character with Albert Gay, and then Roscoe and Lapine seem to be more of and more commonalities with their character. Not to say they're the same, but they share some commonalities anyway.
Yeah, kind of like in those first two cases, more of like a paranoia and a grudge against society or certain segments of society. Whereas the last two guys, the bombers, they're really schemers. This has got a financial purpose. And so not typically what we think of when we think of a mass murderer. We have two examples there, right, in Canadian history of people who've committed really devastating mass murders using something other than guns, you know, bombs, which are much more devastating, and just doing it for money.
Now, you have 25 cases in this book, and we've just been able to delve and put our toe in the water in terms of with four cases in this incredible book. And so tell us just a little bit about overall what is included with these 25 cases. What do you cover in terms of the scope of what you are trying to convey in this book, Rampage, with the 25 killers? What does it encompass?
Okay, well, first of all, we look at the problems of how we define mass murders and spree killing, and I give examples of each. And then I look at the problems with those definitions. So we have, for instance, one of the guys in there, Swift Runner. That's actually a really fascinating case. This was essentially a psychotic Cree man in the 19th century who believed that he had become possessed by the spirit of a Wendigo, and proceeded to, during one winter, devoured his eight members of his family out in the wilds. Now, the interesting thing about Swift Runner is he killed his son first, his son, and then within a day or two, killed six other members of his family, including four at the same time, at the same crime scene. And then he stayed with his one son for months later before finally killing his son. So in the first instance, we have locations seemingly in the same incident where he kills the son and then kills other members of his family. So that seems to indicate a spree killing. But then when he's actually at that next location, he kills four people in a single incident, which is a mass murder. But then he stays with the son for a long time, enough to cool off, seemingly, and kills him later. So are we looking at someone who's a serial killer or a spree killer or a mass murderer or all of the above? I propose the same challenges looking at Roser Bilodeau, who was the first postal worker who went postal that I can find so far, and this was in Canada, actually. So I look at him through that. Robert Poulin, who shot up St. Pius X school in Ottawa, and David Shearing, the Wells Gray gunman, who was really like a sex offender that used mass murder as a way to facilitate his crimes. So that's just in the first two chapters of the book. I look at those. Then I look at the first rampage killers in Canadian history. And so just to kind of get an idea of like the ones that were reported, and that's a lot of domestic homicides, but interesting historical cases nevertheless. I look at some personality disorders. I use the three offenders and look at one who's a narcissist, one who's an antisocial personality disorder, and one who seems to be a psychopath, Roscoe being the last of that. And so that gets into the cases of Valerie Fabricant at Concordia, Robert Raymond Cook, who seems to have killed his family out in the prairies. And then I look at spree killers, which is something that we didn't get to cover on this show really yet with any spree killers. But I actually came up with a typology for spree killers because there wasn't one. So I thought, well, why not? So I started lining up all the Canadian spree killers and seeing if I can find some patterns. So I came up with these four categories of spree killers, three of which I could see in Canada. And the one category is the utilitarian, and which I don't mean in the philosophical sense, but I mean that this is someone who kills out of utility. Like they need a car, they need money to get away from the cops, they need a gun. So they're always committing murders basically to just further their own immediate cause, which oftentimes is just running from the police. I gave the cases of Gregory McMaster and Jesse Yimson. To look at the utilitarian. I looked at this category, the exterminator, which is when you have a killer who goes on a rampage, but specifically to take out a certain group in society. And so I have Marcello Palma there, who on Victoria Day, it was either 95 or 96, it was in Toronto. On Victoria Day, he just decided he was going to kill sex workers. So he killed three sex workers in downtown Toronto and then just kind of went missing. They eventually catch him. And then I looked at Stephen Marshall, who was from Cape Breton, and he actually went on a rampage in the States and was going door to door killing registered sex offenders in Maine. I look at with him the similarities between him and Mark Lapine, because I think there's a tendency for people to think, well, this Stephen Marshall guy, he doesn't sound so bad, he's just getting rid of scum. And I really try and address, you know, what I consider to be a misconception. I mean, this guy isn't a hero. He's just looking for a way to justify wanting to kill. And so I get into a lot of his psychological background there, look at some of the documents from his youth, and I compare it to Mark Lapine and say, look, there's kind of a similar thing happening here. And then finally, the last type of spree killer I look at is a signature killer. That's one typically driven by, you know, deviant sexual impulses, paraphilia. And one of the cases I look at under there is one of the probably the most hideous cases I've ever heard of, and I can't believe it's not more well known. It's of this guy, Dale Merle Nelson, who I think it was September 4th and 5th, 1970. It was the start of hunting season, and he'd just been drinking all day. There's some reports, actually, that he may have taken acid, too, and he just kind of flipped, and he started going around. They were somehow related to him, but he went to this woman's house, and she had, I think it was three daughters, and he bashed her head in and then raped one of her daughters. But then he started getting into, like, corpse mutilation and necrophilia and cannibalism, and then he mass murders an entire family that same night. So that is probably one of the most... I think that's the most grotesque case I've ever written about in Canadian history, which is surprising that it actually upstaged the serial killers, you know, as a spree killer, but that Dale Merle Nelson, so that's in there. And then I look at the typology of mass murderers that was proposed by Holmes and Holmes, and use cases to illustrate that. So we have family annihilator, someone who wants to wipe out their family. I used Leonard Hoag, who was a cop who had robbed a warehouse or something in British Columbia, and he was about to get caught for it and decided to take his family with him. That was in the 60s, so I look at him as a family annihilator. I look at disciples and ideological killers through looking at the Order of the Solar Temple. I mean, that's half a show there, just talking about those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely crazy. It's one of these cults like, you know, Jonestown or the Manson family, whatever have you. But these guys actually had mass suicides and mass murders going on almost simultaneously around the globe, including in Quebec. So I look at that, the Order of the Solar Temple. I look at typical disgruntled employee. I use Pierre Lebrun, who shot up the OC Transport Depot. There I look at him as an example of that. Disgruntled citizen, that's basically a citizen who just kind of loses their marbles and shoots up things seemingly without a real motive that makes sense. The closest I could find for that was Denny Lorty, who went commando and killed three people, wounded 13 in Quebec, attempting to take out the PQ. And then I look at set and run killers. Those are killers that start fires or set bombs. So Albert Gay is under that. That's a perfect example of your set and run killer. And finally, I end with psychotic killers. And I look at the very interesting case of Victor Hoffman, who was the Shell Lake murderer. And this guy was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. He was having vivid hallucinations that he was seeing, kind of like a black-furred devil, and this devil was telling him to kill. And they'd let him out of the psychiatric institution anyways, and he ended up just killing a family in a farmhouse. So that's pretty much the scope of the book right there. You know, looking at killers as examples of different personality disorders and looking at them within these typologies.
Yeah, it's a comprehensive study, and it's very, very entertaining because it's, again, for anybody, even in Canada, just most of these characters are not known at all, never mind well-known. And for anybody outside of Canada, there's enough character that you won't be bored by these Canadian killers by any means. And a fine analysis, and again, kudos for the incredible amount of research and that you had to put into compiling this fine book. Now, you've been on this...
Thanks, Dan.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I also wanted to mention, because the last time you were here, you have your fingers in, your very prolific fingers in all kinds of other things, and writing is what you're doing full-time. But you also have something, a fine publication called Serial Killer Quarterly. And I know that you said you were just in Europe for a little bit. So tell us a little bit about Serial Killer Quarterly and what's new, and just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Okay, so Serial Killer Quarterly, the idea was to bring back some of those old True Detective-type magazines, kind of cut out a bunch of the more seedier elements of it. So those covers, which I'm actually told that a lot of people have very fond nostalgic memories about, the covers of scantily clad women being put in trunks and such, we decided to sort of get rid of that element. It didn't really seem that was something that we wanted to do or that should be done, you know, where we are in the 21st century. We kind of got rid of those seedier elements of it, but yet we concentrated on providing really good, high-quality true crime articles about these serial killers. And so I started to build up a roster of writers, which is, it blows my mind that they all got on board, but, you know, Catherine Ramsland, Harold Schechter, Michael Newton, Kathy Scott, Burl Bear, a whole bunch of them. And so we put out 8 issues of this Serial Killer Quarterly, which is kind of like an e-magazine of, which is taking the idea of the old True Detective magazines. We've put out 8 of them so far. So the issues we've done this year was Fatal Fetishist number 1 and Fatal Fetishist number 2. That was winter and spring. And that just looked at cases of serial killers who have all kinds of different paraphilias, going from stuff as kind of well-known and obvious as pedophilia, and then kind of getting a little more out there, looking at sexual sadists and necrophiles, and then even getting into some really bizarre ones like hair fetish killers, killers that have partialist fetishes for legs, or bondage enthusiasts. So we covered almost like 15 of those offenders in the first 2 Fatal Fetishist issues, and they're both available. You can get them in PDF form from www.serialkillerquarterly.com, or if you want to just get them in an ebook form on Amazon, type in Serial Killer Quarterly, Fatal Fetishist, and they'll come up. And the latest issue was actually on psychotic killers, so that's killers that are motivated partially or almost completely by mental illness in the form of, you know, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders. And so in that one, we looked at Herb Mullen. And Herb Mullen was a guy who killed 13 people in California because he believed that he needed to sacrifice people for Mother Earth. And if he didn't do that, then these earthquakes would destroy California. And his whole reasoning was that the Vietnam War was winding down, and there was seemingly less casualties from that, and that corresponded with an increase in seismic activity in California. And to him, in this kind of psychotic magical thinking, he connects the two. You know, one causes the other. And so in order to stop California from being destroyed, he kills 13 people. And so, psychotic killers has got about 6 or 7 cases like that, just some really outlandish, unbelievable reasons why people are killed. One guy was trying to replenish his blood supply because he believed that Nazis were using UFOs to turn his blood into powder, and he thought this was happening because there was goo under his soap in the soap dish. So that's an example of some of the stories.
Yeah, incredible. Now, for those who would like to know a little bit more about some of the other works that you have, and you said you run Dundurn, but also there's a Grinning Press and there's a Serial Killer Quarterly.
Grinning Man, yeah.
Are you have a Facebook page or a website that people can go to get more information and or purchase some of the material that we've been talking about tonight?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you just want to know about me, Lee Mellor, LeeMellor.com. That as much as I can keep that up to date, that's got links to all the stuff I'm doing, my books, the magazine. But for Serial Killer Quarterly, that's simple, SerialKillerQuarterly.com. You can go there and you can get the PDFs or links out to Amazon with the ebooks there. We're actually just working on that a page for Grinning Man Press itself. As a publisher, as we're now expanding outside Serial Killer Quarterly, and we're going to be publishing true crime books and some fiction works too.
Great.
So look for that coming on the horizon soon. I got some really exciting projects there. I do have on Facebook. I have a page for Grinning Man Press. I have a Serial Killer Quarterly page that's been really booming. I think we're either close to or above 1,000 fans on that now, and we get more every day. And then I have one for Cold North Killers and one for Rampage, and I do my best to try and keep those updated every time there's a new serial killer potentially or confirmed in Canada. I'll usually post news related to that on Cold North Killers. If it's a mass murder or spree killing, I do that on the Rampage site.
Well, that's good work, and like I say, you're a very prolific guy and hardworking at this, and deserve all the success that you're getting with this, and a very fine product with Serial Killer Quarterly, and this Rampage is just jam-packed. It's an incredible amount of research and great, great writing and fantastic stories. So I want to thank you very much, Lee, for coming on and talking about Rampage, Canadian Mass Murder, and Spree Killing, and thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you in the near future.
Oh, I hope so, Dan. It's always a pleasure to be on this show. We always, I think, get in the show deeper than I'm able to go on into in a lot of radio programs. And so I'm always happy to come on, and you're a wonderful host. And thank you for having me again.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for the kind words. And you have yourself a great evening. And again, I'll talk to you in the near future. Thank you, Lee.
Okay, great. Bye, Dan.
Good night. Good night.